which is exactly
it.
Good afternoon. Thank you for coming. We host three classes in restoration history each year that are sponsored by the Churches of Christ Heritage Center, which is on the second floor of Payson Library. If you haven't been up there, you've still got tomorrow and Friday. The entire building closes at 6 o'clock Friday for 15 months. So we are frantically moving out of this place that has been our home for me for the last 6 years with the Heritage Center, moving to a building 9 miles from here in Calabasas. The entire collection, my archive went Friday. That was 276 banker's boxes. I've collected a lot through my life. I have no shame in saying, are you going to be using that? Could I? Those old letters you have, right? You have any interest in those? Are you going to throw that book out? I mean, I would take that if you... So whatever I've collected, all that went over on Friday. But the Heritage Center still has, if you walk over there and see, the Michael Casey collection, the collection that I went over and got in Japan, Motoyuki Nomura, went over there in 2009 and brought that back. Foy Smith's collection is in there. My collection is in there. And then I have a changing exhibit, and so the exhibit is laid out, documents on tables in there. Put out an article by Shelley, just because I knew she was going to be walking in a minute. Just wanted to surprise her that her article was out there. One year I laid out a pamphlet called How to Lead the Lord's Singing by John Wilson, and he didn't know it was going to be out there. John wrote that when he was a teenager, probably, and How to Lead Singing, and I brought that out. So all these old documents, if you have time to go to the Heritage Center, it opens at 11 in the morning, closes at 6. So it just happened this year that all three of our classes are about individuals. This one on Emma Johnson, tomorrow on William Kincaid, and on Friday, Jeremiah Sullivan Black. Our guest here today is Dr. James Gorman. I'm going to call him Jamie because everybody calls him Jamie. He did his MDiv at Abilene. Went on to Baylor for his PhD. Was that in history or church history?
Religion, history of Christianity.
History of Christianity. Mm-hmm. He's now assistant professor, soon to be associate professor, at Johnson University in Knoxville, Tennessee, not far from the University of Tennessee. Beautiful campus. I was there recently. This is the old school that was called Johnson Bible College. It was started by Ashley Johnson. We've known a lot about Ashley Johnson, but nothing about his wife. I don't think anybody's ever given a talk about her that I'm aware of. We had the president here at Pepperdine called Howard A. White. He was our fifth president. And I said to him one day, Dr. White, what does that A stand for? And he said, Ashley. And I said, was that your mother's family? And he said, no, my dad thought Ashley Johnson hung the moon. I was named for Ashley Johnson of Johnson Bible College in Knoxville, Tennessee. And then he named his oldest boy Ashley. So we've had two Ashleys here at Pepperdine. But today, if you saw your title, we're about to hear the lecture called Your Mother in the Gospel, Emma Johnson as Matriarch and President of Johnson University, after her husband died. The PhD dissertation that Jamie wrote at Baylor is called Transatlantic Evangelical Missions Culture and the Rise of the Campbell Movement. So what is the background to Alexander Thomas Campbell and his son Alexander Campbell? This began with an article that a lot of us in this room read in the Restoration Quarterly. The article that he published in the Quarterly right as he began doing his research was called The European Roots of Thomas Campbell's Declaration and Address, The Evangelical Society of Ulster, which is Northern Ireland. No one had done that research. It is groundbreaking research, what he did, to help us understand the background to Thomas Campbell getting all these ideas, in which he incorporates in the Declaration and Address in 1809. But we're not doing that today. We're doing Emma Johnson, and this will be exciting. Will you welcome to Pepperdine Dr. Jamie Gorman from Johnson University?
I think I know what I'm going to say, but I'm going to stick to my notes. Yeah, I'm going to need that. Well, first of all, thanks so much to Jerry and to the Heritage Center. We're so thankful for the work that you all are doing to preserve our documents. I want you to go back with me to 1891. October 1891, Emma Elizabeth Johnson gave birth to her first child, a son. Emma almost died in that childbirth, but she made it, even though her son didn't. The child didn't live. I think it's hard to estimate the impact of this particular experience in the formation of Emma Johnson's identity as mother. She never had biological children. However, I'm convinced that Emma's identity as mother became the center of her self-understanding. It's how she understood her entire calling to the world. She was a mother. She was a mother to sons. She was a mother of sons in the gospel. They were her students. Her identity as a teacher of the Bible, as a servant in the kingdom of God, as president of a Bible college in the 1920s. Yes, that's right. In the 1920s, her identity in all these roles was as a mother to the students. That's what I found in the documents that we have at Johnson. The students of Johnson Bible College who were training to be preachers, these were Emma's sons, and she, their mother. And the Johnsons came to see their identity as parents in a providential way. For example, in the Johnsons later said about October 1891, that fateful day, that the Lord had taken away their only child, but in his place had given them thousands of sons. Emma Johnson was an extraordinary woman, yet very few people know anything about her. She was one of the first women presidents of a Bible college. Emma served as president of Johnson Bible College for the last 2 years of her life, from 1925 to 1927. But she also filled the role of vice president for 3 decades before that. For all 3 of those decades, she was one of the few faculty members. She taught the students Bible. She and Ashley were the Bible teachers. They had other faculty there. And this is a conservative school. They train men to be preachers. And so she taught hundreds of preachers to read the Bible for her 3 decades of service in Christian higher education from the 1890s to the 1920s. But she was more than a professor to these young men training to preach. She was their mother in the gospel. So, I want to tell Emma's story today, and I want to focus on 2 major points to sort of give us some focus. First of all, I want to tell the story of her presidency to demonstrate that despite her short tenure of like 2.5 years, she made some really key decisions for the university in a really, really important time, the 1920s, for the Christian churches. So that's the first thing I want to say, that her presidency, the one that I'm finding anyway in the documents at Johnson University, demonstrates her theological wisdom and her influential role in leading Johnson Bible College in what I call the turbulent 20s. So that's the first point. Her presidency proved very influential. The second point that I kind of really want to focus on today is more actually of a question. And the question is, why on earth can't I find anyone freaking out that there is a woman as a president of a Bible college which is solely devoted to training preachers? I cannot find, it's wild, right? I have not yet found, that doesn't mean that they don't exist, I have not yet found a published critique of Emma's presidency. I mean, women had only achieved a right to vote 5 years before her presidency. And yeah, women had been ordained in some of the more progressive churches for 4 or 5 decades in the Stone Campbell movement at that point. But there were no women presidents of universities. I mean, even major progressive secular universities don't have presidents until the late 20th century, 5 decades after Emma was president of a Bible college. So I'm going to note, that's a big question for me. I'm going to note numerous reasons why, and I'll give you three specific reasons why that I found anyway, and they all relate back to this one major point, that she was mother of Johnson Bible College. She had become the matriarch, and I think that's really important. So, Emma Elizabeth Johnson. She was born Emma Elizabeth Strong in 1863. She was born in Dunville, Canada. Dunville, Ontario. She is the oldest of 3 sisters, so you see her here in the middle. Not sure exactly of the date there on that picture. We have tons of good pictures at Johnson University, but they don't always assign like, you know, when they were or even who it is. But this is her and her 2 sisters. Emma's father was a businessman who had invested in land in Toronto, so her childhood experience resembled upper middle class affluence, with some exposure to the genteel life. For instance, she spent 1 year at the College for Ladies in Hamilton, Ontario, and in an 1881 census of Dunville, her family listed one servant, so they at least had that. So they were a little bit wealthy. So here is Dunville. You can see the this is my Google map, so just ignore all the stars. Those are places I've gone or want to go. but they would make the trip down here. It was about a couple-day trip with train. They would go from Knoxville, which is just off the map down here. They would go from Knoxville to Cincinnati, Cincinnati to Cleveland, Cleveland to Buffalo, and then they would make their way. In Emma's diaries, we have two years, 1911 and 1917. Those are the ones that are extant, and she describes going up and coming back in those. It was usually a 2 or 3 day trip. So this is where she was from. This is her parents. This is J.D. Strawn. This is her mother, Ella. They called her Ella Strawn. This is Emma, and this is Ashley. Ashley's handing her mother a flower. And this is Showpup. He shows up in a lot of the pictures doing his little trick thing, right? This is another picture of her parents, J.D. and Ella, in 1915. And this is a picture of Emma and Ashley, her husband, much later in 1911. The whole family went to Grimsby Park and Grimsby Beach to celebrate their parents' 50th year anniversary.
Is this Grimsby Beach?
Yes, this is Grimsby. This is them at Grimsby Beach, yes. Emma met her husband, Ashley Johnson, when he attended, when he was up in Ontario attending the Philadelphia School of Elocution and Oratory in Ontario, Canada. Ashley was already gathering fame in his preaching, but he was still working on it. Now, Ashley and Emma came from very different backgrounds, and in some ways, they were an unlikely match. One of Ashley and Emma's biographers perceived that their contrasting qualities is exactly what made them the perfect fit to have a successful college, to found a successful college, and to perpetuate that vision. This biographer, you should know, however, because it matters, was Alva Ross Brown, a Johnson Bible College graduate and the third president of Johnson Bible College, handpicked by Emma, and he did not hide his biases when he wrote. All right, so Brown's account of the Johnsons are what historians call hagiographical. They're hagiographies. That is, his goal when writing about them was to praise and to revere and to honor them. Not only did he romanticize his two heroes, but he crafted his accounts of them to portray both Emma and Ashley as these perfect manifestations of their genders, according to the expectations of that time. So Ashley was a man's man, and Emma was a real woman's woman. So with that caveat, you've heard, according to Brown, Emma's urban, refined, cultured, and gentle character perfectly balanced Ashley's mountainous and adventurous and rough-hewn nature. Now, whether or not Brown's account is entirely accurate, the two individuals did come from very different backgrounds, right? I mean, she was a city girl from a family who had some money. He was a country boy from a family without. But regardless, they met in that summer of 1884, and they hit it off, and they got married that year, December 31st, 1884. Now, it's not a major focus of my paper today, but you should know that they were deeply in love for all of their years, and this deep love emerges in the letters. His letters to her, we don't have many letters from her to him, but we do have his to her, and in the couple years of the diaries that we have of hers. Whether it was the ritual kiss every time they walked by the kissing oak near campus, as you see here, or Ashley's touching his nose to the ground before her when she wore a new dress or something that looked particularly nice, or the public displays of affection around the office and around the campus, they kept the romance alive through the good times and through the bad. So the newlyweds spent a couple of years of ministry in South Carolina and Georgia, but they eventually moved back to Ashley's hometown in Knox County, Tennessee, and they worked full-time in education. Their first project was known as the Correspondence Bible College, founded in 1886. Ashley was, he conceived of this idea of this Correspondence Bible College when he was the state evangelist for South Carolina Missionary Cooperation in 1883. He was really concerned to train preachers who didn't have money. There wasn't a whole lot of education opportunity in Tennessee, really, really low education rates, and there were a lot of people that wanted to be preachers that didn't have education. So that was his vision, and it continues to drive the college today. It's one of the cheapest colleges to go to in Tennessee, cheapest private colleges. So what he came up with was this Correspondence Bible College. It was a four-year college, a four-year course of study that they did through the mail. And it was a big hit. From 1886 to 1912, they enrolled about 3,000 students. And Ashley and Emma worked on this all the time. Well, they decided they also wanted to make this a face-to-face school where they could provide education for, and this is a famous famous quote, and it's even etched on the old main building still today. You can go to and see this. "Open day and night to the poor young man who desires above every other desire to preach the gospel of Christ," founded by Ashley and Emma Johnson. Now, many people were skeptical at first, including Emma, of this shift from the Correspondence Bible College to the School of Evangelists. However, there was an individual who gave Ashley $100, and off he went, building this school. And in 1893, they founded the School of Evangelists. Now, the School of Evangelists is in the context of the Bible College movement in the late 19th century. The School of Evangelists was one of about a dozen Bible colleges that were founded in this period in the late 19th century. The Bible College movement was largely a response to the revivalism of Moody, and it was also a response to the growth of liberal thought in American Protestant colleges. All the Bible colleges, they had different goals, but they did all seek to prepare students for Christian ministry through a program that really centered on the Bible and practical ministry. So that's what they were doing. Beyond college training, the School of Evangelists also had an academy for those who had not yet completed high school, which was a real problem in Tennessee at this time. The curriculum at the beginning resembled Bethany College. That's the college that Alexander Campbell founded. Ashley was a big fan of that liberal arts education style, and it still dominates Johnson's curriculum today. So the School of the Evangelists was nestled in the hills of East Tennessee, and still is, tucked inside one of the curves, the French Broad River that you see on this picture. About 12 miles southeast of Knoxville, you can see here Ashley, Emma, and Show Pup again making it into the picture. Given transportation options at the time, it was basically a full-day commitment to travel to town. And they traveled to town a lot, at least once a week usually, based on the diary from 1911 and 1917. They go to town a lot. About a three-hour trip in. They would take the carriage, and you can see this is the School of Evangelists here. They called this the Hack, and they would take it down town and do their shopping regularly. The school also ran a farm, and it had numerous other jobs so that poor students could work. They had three options. You could work totally for like a year and then get a couple years education, or you could do a combination of work and pay in order to get your education. So the school was it was secluded, and it turned into kind of like a family farm place of education. So it became like a giant domestic sphere in some sense. It was like a big educational family. In an essay celebrating the 10-year anniversary in 1903, Ashley and Emma, they wrote this article in the catalog, and they called it God's Little Farm. So the students, they weren't simply students. The Johnsons called them or referred to them as the boys. They called them Johnson's boys, and sometimes they called them their sons. I have all kinds of stuff I could share with you. I'll just share a couple. In 1904, the catalog revealed this familial environment and educational philosophy by noting that the School of Evangelists would be unhappy if one of their, quote, sons in the gospel knew more about history and philosophy than they did about the Bible. All right? So there's a couple things there. You get the familial metaphor, but you also get their real concern to make, they care deeply about philosophy and history. But Bible was the center, right? That's that Bible school, Bible college movement. In the same fashion, in the 1907 catalog, there's a whole section entitled "The Kind of Boys That We Seek." They were looking for upright, moral kids who wanted to be preachers above all things. Don't come here if your heart is not set on preaching. If you want to preach, we'll make it happen. So the boys' terminology and the whole familial metaphors, all of them, they dominate, they permeate both the published stuff and the internal records. This is just the way they viewed things. So Emma served as a faculty member and vice president of the School of Evangelists and Johnson Bible College, which was its name in 1909. You see here one picture of the faculty. The School of Evangelists started printing its catalogs in 1900. They didn't print catalogs before that. And she was listed as the vice president from 1900 up until 1925, when she started being listed as the president. She was listed as a professor in all those years as well. And only her and Ashley were listed as Bible professors until the 1920s, when other people started taking that over. She taught Old Testament history, Bible geography, New Testament, the Gospels, and Acts. And that's just the stuff I've uncovered. You know, I learned more stuff as I was reading her diaries, including Bible geography. That was never listed, but she went and taught it to seniors and juniors, or seniors and sophomore all the time. She was also the college, she and the college pastor constituted a standing committee on the chapel planning. So she planned chapels with the chaplain. So Emma's role in all of these categories made her foundational to this entire work of training a whole generation of preachers at Johnson Bible College. When the student body petitioned the president to change the school's name, this is in 1909, from the School of Evangelists to the Johnson Bible College, they did so on several grounds. I'll skip the first couple, but the third one, the students said, and we have the letter from the students in the archives, finally, they wanted Johnson in the name of the college instead of the School of Evangelists, and I'm quoting from the letter, "As you and Sister Johnson have given your lives unselfishly to the cause, by your sacrifice and self-denial made the school possible, the name of our college should also include your name." And about 90% of the students signed off on this petition. And it worked. They changed the college to Johnson, the name to Johnson Bible College. The students had pointed out the example and sacrifice of both Ashley and Emma for justification of renaming the school after them. After all, they were already calling their graduates the Johnson Boys in all sorts of literature that you find at this time. These are Johnson Boys. So at 62 years of age, I'm skipping a bunch of history here, but at 62 years of age, Emma became the president of Johnson University after her husband died on January the 14th, 1925. You see an image of the funeral here. Ashley's health had been bad for a long time. In the diaries that we have, she's constantly mentioned he has these debilitating headaches. They plagued him. They sometimes stopped him from traveling. So she had been over the presidential responsibilities probably for about 10 years before she actually became the official president. So she knew the job very well. She knew the job responsibilities. Emma's support at this time was really astounding. When Ashley died, and I just went through and counted them, in the archives extant, she got 325 letters around, that's what we've got right now, of sympathy and support of her in this new role as president. So a lot of people knew that Ashley died. They wrote her, and it was published in the journals. And they knew that she had become president, but I have not yet found a published or archival source in which someone critiqued Emma for taking the office of president at a Bible college whose sole purpose was to train ministers. The closest thing I have found to any kind of criticism is in Alva Ross Brown's account. Brown wrote that it was almost unanimous. I don't know how much to make of the almost, but that's what he said, so I suspect there may have been some critique. It was almost unanimous among all constituencies that she was the logical choice for next president. So as far as I know, the almost person didn't publish or didn't end up in the records that I found yet. So Emma, though, she knew this was unusual. According to Brown, she had mentioned it to him, that she wasn't sure if a woman should be in charge of a college. Nonetheless, she took over. Just in case you're not familiar with the 1920s, this is wild stuff. In the 1920s, for instance, most people had the idea of that there were separate spheres for men and women, right? There were spaces, and those spaces were gendered. The idea here was that people associated public space with masculinity and private space with femininity. Now, this is a generalization. Obviously, it's a spectrum, right? But just understand, in the 1920s, most people thought that the separate spheres for women and men assumed that only men were suited for the harsh public world of business and politics and economics, and that women were humble, pious, submissive, and meek, natural protectors of the home, nurturers of children, and pillars of the church. All right, so that's why you don't have a lot of women in public roles at this time. Now, you have folks moving into that in that direction, but this is out of the norm as far as gender goes. It's also out of the norm for education. There was almost no opportunity for women to get higher education even before the Civil War. After the Civil War, all-female colleges started up, and the all-female colleges gave a place for women to get higher education. It also made space for women to become professors and even presidents of the all-female colleges, but not Bible colleges that trained men for preaching. That's crazy. And the secular institutions, progressive ones, don't even have women presidents until the late 20th century. So Emma's 5 decades ahead of her time. She clearly subverted both the educational norms and the gender norms of her day. And she did it at a fairly conservative Bible college. So, as you can imagine, my question, as I already told you, is why on earth no opposition? Well, let me give you 3 reasons that I found in the documents. First of all, a really powerful reason, she and Ashley had planned it. In 1922, they deeded their property and their personal assets to Johnson Bible College. That deed is filed with Knox County Court. And in the deed, they explicitly said, if he dies before her, she becomes president, has all the powers of president. So that is a major reason. And Emma, she wanted to make sure that people were aware that it was Ashley. She wrote in a couple of places to make the public aware. She reiterated Ashley's desire for her to be successor in a letter to alumni directly after he died. It was an appeal for money because we need electricity. That's what the letter. And she says explicitly to her supporters, I'm quoting from her letter, he was unchanging in his desire that I should succeed him as president of Johnson Bible College. And she noted that she had labored by his side for more than 30 years in the work. And she assured readers that the school was theirs, the supporters, the old faithful guard, as she called them in this letter, and that she and Ashley had only been instruments to see the Lord's work carried on. She wrote a similar, only longer, explanation in one of the major journals, Christian Evangelist, about a page long, about the same time. So that's one major reason. The second major reason was approval. The public approved. And it was explicit and written down. So she received hearty approval and endorsement from people, from churches, and from the board of trustees and colleges. Some of those were published approval, and they were quick. So, for example, the board of trustees, they met January 20th, 6 days after Ashley died, and they produced 2 resolutions, which are in the document that you see here. And they printed them in both the Christian Standard and the Christian Evangelist. These are the 2 leading journals among independent Christian churches at the time. And those 2 resolutions, the trustees resolved, and I'm quoting from this, that we hereby express our sympathy and assurance of our prayers and our complete confidence in her ability to carry on the great work of God. We pledge our loyal and constant support in carrying out the great work of Johnson Bible College. Also of note, just a quick aside, one of the 5 trustees at this time was a woman by the name of Helen Campbell, and she was a major helper of Emma at the college. Emma received equal affirmation and support in letters. All right, so that's the published side, but she also got really interesting support. So one example will suffice for now. There was a man by the name of Robert Hahn, and he wrote to Emma in response to Ashley's death, and I've got some of the quotes here on the screen for you. He addressed Emma as my dear mother in Christ, and he passed to her not only his personal encouragement, but the encouragement of his entire congregation in Windsor, Ontario. He said that Emma and Ashley knew his spiritual life and its possibilities for service far better than any other, not even accepting my own mother in the flesh. Do you see that he calls her his mother in Christ and his biological mother the mother in flesh? And you see who knows more about his soul? The Christian Church in Windsor devoted their Sunday morning hour to prayer. We're up in Canada now. We're having an entire devotion, or our entire church is devoted to prayer for Ashley's great work and for Emma's new leadership of that work. And that same evening that they're celebrating and praying for Ashley and Emma, the church elders led the creation of a statement to Emma, and the entire congregation ratified it. And here's what the statement of the congregation, they express, and I'm quoting, our sympathy, our assurance of prayerful support, and confident belief in the future triumph of the Lord's work beneath your hand. That's a really cool metaphor. We have confident belief in the future triumph of the Lord's work beneath your hand. So Hans signed the letter, lovingly and sorrowfully, your son in the gospel. Letters like the one from Robert Hahn and his Christian church in Canada demonstrate really that Emma was affirmed and supported by her former students and by their congregations. So I'm painting a picture here. She's got support all over the board, all across the board. Horn's letter also evidences the 3rd major point that I want to make for why on earth no criticism. She had become the matriarch of Johnson Bible College, and consequently a mother in the gospel of a whole generation of preachers. Hahn explicitly stated that Emma, his mother in Christ, knew him better than his biological mother. And Hahn was not the only preacher who looked at Emma as his mother. There was a man by the name of Allen. He had no last name in the letter. He actually wrote her a couple letters from Denver, Colorado in 1925. And he addressed Emma as dearest mother in the gospel. And he signed off as your loving son in the gospel. Another man by the name of Ernest Warden wrote Emma on May 25th, near the end of her life. And he addressed her as dear mother Johnson. And he called himself one of your boys. Emma wrote to someone in September of 1925. And there is no name. I have no idea who it was to because the envelope was gone. It's just to my dear son. I know from the letter that it was a returning student. The first session, he was going to be returning for the first session that Emma was president. And she encouraged him to bring back only those boys who wanted to preach the gospel. They're constantly getting rid of people who use tobacco. Ugh, tobacco, it was like the thing, right? That's what you had to sign on to if you're coming to Johnson in the day. Indeed, Albert Ross Brown, who you see pictured here, he said, her husband believed that she was a mother to more preachers than any other woman of her own generation. She placed the influence of her queenly life upon hundreds. But through it all, she remained retiring and free from pride. So he really wants to point out her virtue. Because, Brown sort of emphasizes the fact that she could be president and mother, not just because she's free from pride, but because she is the ideal virtuous woman, as far as Brown sees it. I'll give you another quote from Brown here to help you see. He puts it this way, more striking than her rich brown eyes and expressive face was the beauty of soul which these revealed. Many times her husband declared that she was the purest minded person he had ever known. Ever careful about her person, extremely chaste in her selection of words, and painstaking in every action, she was a fit woman to talk to young preachers about the glory of Christian service and culture. For Brown, she was an ideal president and matriarch because, in Brown's eyes, she was the ideal virtuous woman. Someone else might not be so fit to talk to preachers about the gospel. So to sum up, the reason no criticism, as far as I can tell, it was their plan. Everyone approved it publicly and privately that we know of or that I've found so far. And she had become the matriarch of the place. These people looked to her as their... She taught them how to read the Bible for 3 decades. She was the matriarch. She was their mother in Christ. Emma's presidency lasted for about 2.5 years. From January 1925 to May of 1927. So let me highlight just a few interesting things about her tenure. First of all, you can see this is an application form from 1925. I've boxed in a couple of things that I think are pretty interesting. You can see there on the first one, or maybe you can't see, actually, I'll read you. It says, is it your supreme desire to preach the gospel? All right, to be a preacher of the gospel. So if that's not your concern, don't come here. All right, we don't want to, I mean, we want to teach all this stuff, but we're wasting our time if you don't want to preach the gospel. That's what we're doing. The second one is, do you belong to the Church of Christ? All right. Are you a member? And this is an independent Christian church at the time, but lots of folks in the North still today call themselves Churches of Christ. On the back side, you can see a couple more things. Did you ever use tobacco and when did you quit? Are you still hooked? Right. And then there's a much longer. Do you understand that the possession and use of tobacco in any form, either on or off the college grounds, that pipes, cigarettes, pasties, cards, guns, revolvers, profanity, vulgarity, and anything else detrimental to a Christian are absolutely outlawed at Johnson Bible College? In Emma's diaries, she talks about having to dismiss a few of the boys for using tobacco. And she was worried because they went up to Lexington and then they left, and she was very concerned about them, but they weren't going to stay there if they were using tobacco. So that gives you an idea of some of the guidelines in order to enter the college. I've also got the letterhead. You can't quite see, but this is Mrs. Ashley S. Johnson, president. And on the letterhead, you have several things to sort of sum up the college. And so I've blown up this little section here, a preacher training institution and a preacher growing atmosphere, right? That's in most all of the documents for most of the college's history in those early days. And then I've highlighted some of these sidebars here. High school, the courses they offered were high school for 4 years, and they offered a 4-year college degree. Emma filed with the Department of the Interior in the U.S. in 1926, so I have some of the numbers. In the preparatory school, that is the high school, there were 66 men and 9 women students, 8 male professors and 1 woman. That would be Emma. In the professor, in the college, and it's in the theology section, there are 51 male students and 5 women students. And there are 4 male professors and 1 female professor at that time, which obviously was also Emma. They also had these propositions. These are the 3 ways you could go to the school there. You could work for a while and then get 2 years, and then work for a while, get 2 years. You could work for a little bit and pay a little bit, or you could pay it all. These are the 3 ways that you can become a preacher at Johnson. And then this last one, because of time, I'm going to kind of skim by this one. This just gives you the idea. Basically, we teach New Testament Christianity, folks. All right? Deal with it. If you don't like it, don't come here, kind of a thing. All right? So these are kind of the emphases. So Emma's presidential tenure occurred in what I call the turbulent 20s. American society and culture might have been roaring, but in the Stone-Campbell movement, a major controversy was brewing in the 1920s. The controversy eventually led to a second division in the Stone-Campbell movement, as you see on this chart here, wonderfully depicted by one of my students. I give them extra credit if they can build me charts, mostly because mine is ugly and theirs is better. So this is the winner from like last fall in my Restoration History class. So it led to a second division, and you can see that between the independent Christian churches and Churches of Christ and the cooperative or progressive Disciples of Christ. And right here in the 1920s, this is when things are really heating up. All right, this was the decade of decisions for people. People started making organizations and saying, side with us in the 1920s or side with them. It's kind of liberals and conservatives. It's kind of independents and cooperatives. The cooperatives were liberal, the independents were conservative, and there was a ton of diversity, right? So that's a very simplistic picture, in all honesty. However, it is what it is. The major organization that was founded for the independents, the conservatives, was the Christian Restoration Association, founded in 1925. And when they were founded, they wrote Emma. It was James DeForest Murch, one of the leaders of the independent Christian churches, and he was the president of Christian Restoration Association, and he wrote Emma in 1925 at this key moment for the independent Christian churches and said, "Will you affiliate with us?" 2 years later, the leader of the Disciples, the other end of the theological spectrum, Board of Education, they write Emma. They say, "Will you affiliate with us?" To both of them, she says, "No thanks." So I want to get into her denial or these rejections because it demonstrates one of the major points I want to make today. So the first president of Christian Restoration Association, James DeForest Murch, he sent Emma a letter asking, like I just said, to affiliate with the Christian Restoration Association and a 5-page contract noting the requirements. You see here the first of the 5 pages that he sent, which we have in the archives. And you see here her letter to him. This is the first of 3 pages. I don't have the final letter that she sent to him because it was sent to him. But I do have her last, you know, changes of the letter that would eventually go to him. And she makes several points, and I'll just quickly highlight them, about why she would say no. First, she saw it not. She said it was not expedient. There was nothing to be gained for Johnson Bible College. Second, she said, although she doubted not the sincerity of the CRA leaders, the Christian Restoration Association leaders, in her 30 years of successful history, she said she had never seen many such societies and organizations. Actually, she said that they actually hindered the work of the Restoration movement, didn't help it. So she was pretty fiercely independent. And finally, she said, the friends of the school, the people that supported it, she said, they were totally committed to an independent structure as the best course for Johnson Bible College. So she was so independent, she didn't want to affiliate with the independents. She wanted a very independent future for Johnson Bible College. It's massive. The same thing happens in 1927 when Pritchard, who was the secretary of the Disciples of Christ Board of Education, said, please affiliate with us. She said the same thing to him in a shorter letter, just 1 page as you see here. But she said the same thing, but she also added a pragmatic reason saying, we will not affiliate with you. And by the way, her letter to Murch is spicy. It's good. That's what I like to use food metaphors for my primary sources. And if there's a way to describe her letter to Murch, it's spicy. But he was kind in his response. She wasn't nearly as spicy to Pritchard, but she said some stuff that really kind of ticked him off. She said, well, I won't go into what she said for time, but she said some stuff that made him mad, basically along the lines of, yeah, your Board of Education is basically hindering the gospel. We need to be independent. And so she said, no thanks. And he basically sent her a letter back that said, well, you've got us all wrong. And he sent her some literature and said, read this, you know, this is not what we're about. And he also sent her some numbers, like, look how great we're doing. But she still said, no thanks. So I think this is really important, Emma's rejection of these two offers, one from conservative independents and the other from cooperative disciples, during the height of the earliest conflicts and organizational bifurcation of the Christian churches, her decisions took Johnson Bible College in a very direct path. And they also showed her theological and practical reasoning very clearly. I mean, she knew what was going on. She knew how to express it very clearly. She was very well-read on all this stuff. So in these two moments, if Emma had made a different decision either way, it would have drastically changed, no doubt, the future of Johnson Bible College. So around the institution, people have the idea of her as kind of like, oh, she was just kind of a fill-in figure, not that important, just waiting for the next president. And what I'm finding in the documents is not that story. She was actually very influential, getting letters from some of the leaders on both sides of the spectrum, and she's steering Johnson kind of down a middle course. And it's kind of stayed that way, Johnson Bible College. So that's important. I also want to quickly say a couple of things about her at the end of her life. She tackled the presidency with great resolve, but her battle with cancer made her last months of life very difficult. She had breast cancer in 1923 and had her right breast removed, but the cancer returned to her lung. And as her health deteriorated in the spring of 1927, she wasn't able to make the commencement in May. She actually dies at the end of May. But she typed her commencement for somebody to read to the students, and we have it. Yes. And I've got a clip here for you. My dear sons, again comes the sad time, particularly to those who are left behind, when the associations and ties which bound us together for 4 years or more must be broken. It's an especially sad time for me, for another must read this message of mine to you, my sons whom I have loved and to whom I would like to speak in person. College life everywhere is temporary, a period of preparation for greater usefulness. So while ties formed are very dear, we must face the inevitable separation that comes year by year. In Johnson Bible College, we seem to be more like one large family, bound together by cords of love with a oneness of purpose and ideals, as nearly identical as it is possible for individuals to have. Now, I'm skipping several pages of her address to get you to the end. And she says, you can say with Paul now, thus far, that you have fought a good fight, and my last message to you is one of the first you received as you entered upon your study. Study to show thyself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. Your mother in the gospel. It's a suiting final address, I think, to her sons, the only children that she ever really had. Emma died on May 30th, 1927. The Johnson Bible College catalog in 27-28 had a tribute to her in the first three pages. This picture on one side and then two pages of a tribute to her. It celebrated her as the ideal woman and a splendid type of true womanhood. I'm almost certain that Alvin Ross Brown wrote it, because it's all of the stuff that he says in his other places when he talks about her. And after celebrating her womanliness and her characteristics of purity and modesty and calm judgment that balanced Ashley's nature, the memorial claimed that her influence over him was of equal merit, and I quote, to his influence over her. The memorial said, for the love of Christ, she deprived herself of fine things. She worked tirelessly on the details of office work. Her sincere humility was her most admirable trait. And when she learned that her cancer had returned, the memorial said, despite believing that she had been cured, she remained hopeful and patient under the most trying circumstances. And according to the catalog, as her breathing became more laborious, she became more submissive and more cheerful. Her last moments passed in peace. And the memorial ended with this paragraph that's worth reproducing. 1,000 preachers have lost a mother, and thousands everywhere have lost a sincere and appreciative friend. Yet she is lost, but for a little while, in Christian hope. She lived, and so she died. It's surprising that we haven't told her story yet. Sadly, in some sense, the quietness of her life and her witness and her presidency has transferred over into our constructions of history. I'm trying to fix that by telling her story now, and I hope to keep telling it in more detail. She was a wife, Bible professor, vice president, and president, but most importantly of all, I think, she was a mother. She was a mother of sons. She was a mother of sons in the gospel. Now, interestingly, most of her family is buried in Forest Lawn Mausoleum in North Toronto, but not Emma Elizabeth Johnson. She's buried with her family, but not with her family in the flesh. Instead, her body lies on campus at Johnson University with all of her descendants in the gospel. This is her grave right here. It's Ashley and her. I paid my respects before I came, and I said, I hope that you're pleased with the way I tell your story before we came. So, thank you.
Wow. That was wonderful, Jamie. Now, that story hasn't been told. Michael Strickland speaks tomorrow, and will you stand to give a promo of what you're going to do?
Sure.
Wow.
Okay.
Introduce yourself.
I'm Michael Strickland. I'm a professor at Ambridge University. We can tell more about that tomorrow. I invite you to come back. We're going to talk about William Kincaid, who is a figure that just has a very shadowy history with the Restoration Movement, but his story is also worth telling, especially since he is, as far as I can tell, the strongest voice in the Stone Campbell Movement to argue for the continuation of what we would call miraculous spiritual gifts into the modern era. So we'll talk about that. We'll also talk about his opposition to slavery and his important role in making sure that Illinois remained a free state. So come back tomorrow for that.
And he dies how soon before the merger in 1832?
Oh, he died just after it, but he was very ill during that time. Yeah. So yeah, I'll talk about that soon.
Okay. Thank you all for coming. This is a nice room to meet in. And we've had a lot of interesting topics. This was all new to me. Does anybody know, do you know, what years did G.C. Brewer study here? Did she teach G.C. Brewer
how to read? It was before 1925. She most definitely did.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's obviously named for Grover Cleveland Brewer, and Grover Cleveland was president in the 1880s. So I'm assuming G.C. Brewer is here in the early part of the 20th
century. Yeah, if she was there before that, she taught him the Bible.
And Brewer clearly becomes the dominant, best-known preacher in churches. And to see him at the Abilene Lectures in 1936 or something, and to realize his background here, or to take Howard White, the president here, born in 1915 in northern Alabama in a Church of Christ family, and his dad says, going to name you for Ashley Johnson.
Yeah, that's pretty wild.
It's just fascinating, all the different strands here. Thank you all for coming. Hope you can come back tomorrow and hear Michael.
Is it Johnson? Is it still?